It's about that time. Streamers, celebrations, remembrances, old anxiety. In fact, we've crammed the Uber producer, Mark Ristich, into a ball, and we're going to drop him right over Times Square. It's that time of the year where we marvel at where has all the time gone. We get to spin some of our favorite stories from the past 12 months. From PRX and NPR, welcome to the Look Back Special. My name is Glenn Washington. Spank the new baby's bottom. Kick old man 2013 to the curb. Because you're listening to Snap Judgment. Now, to start things off, Snap is traveling east to New York City, where we asked one of hip-hop's princes, MC Homeboy Sandman, to tell Snap how he got to where he is today. Homeboy Sandman, take it away.
This is 2008. When I found out what my true inner passion was, that I was a musician, I said, yo, I'm not losing focus. For me, I'm like, I'm not getting caught up in a rat race. Right now, the things that I'm gonna do for money, it's all gotta be related to my rhymes. I'm nickel and diming, selling CDs, doing shows. I'm trying to make it work. You know, I had managed to pay some rent. I got this fat crib. But then, you know, soon after moving in, fell behind. Falling behind. And the landlord is like, yo, I'm not feeling it. Trying to evict me all types of times. I've been to court on multiple occasions. Comes to a point where I am 5 months behind on my rent. I'm 5 months behind. All right, at almost a grand a month, $5,000 in the hole. So I make the decision, when I go to court tomorrow morning, I'm gonna tell the judge, I give up, I ain't got no money, I'm gonna get out of the place, right? Okay. So next morning I wake up, walk over to the courthouse. When I get into the courthouse, I gotta speak with the court clerk, right? I speak with this woman, and for some reason, who knows why, she's like, yo, what are you gonna do? You're not gonna give the place up, right? Like, what do you mean? You have the record in front of you. I have no money. She says, don't give up. You have to tell the judge you'll get it. Tell the judge give you 15 days. Whatever you gotta do, you can't give up. This is the court clerk, mind you. She's supposed to be on their side. I said, miss, what am I supposed to do? She looks at me with a look in her eye. Like she cares about me, like she feels real concerned for my well-being. And she's like, yo, trust me, B, get 15 days. So I say, all right, fine. She just talked me into telling the judge that I was gonna have the money in 15 days. I go in front of the judge, I say, judge, 15 days, I'll have it. Judge, of course, says, what do you mean 15 days, you'll have it? I say, 15 days, boom, that's, you know what I'm saying? Despite the fact that I clearly have no idea where the money's gonna come from, the judge says, fine, and he gives me 15 days. It doesn't make any sense. Nothing that happened in court that day made sense. I leave, just flabbergasted, and when I get home, sat down, turned the computer on, took the internet that I was stealing from somebody else's internet in the building, and the first email I see, Tag Records, MC competition today, this afternoon, Rucker Park, grand prize, $5,000. Grand prize, $5,000. And when I see this, I feel like a feeling washing over me, or just like, you know, magic of some sort, or divine intervention for real. You know what I'm saying? The prize money was what I owed on this very day. I feel like all I gotta do is show up, win, which is obviously gonna happen based on the psychosis that just took place in the courtroom. And this is crazy to me.
You know what this is? Hey.
It's Jermaine Dupri's Tag Records, right? And I go over there. This place is packed, Rucker Park jam packed, fence to fence, okay? And the crowd was nuts. It was deranged out there. This particular competition, it wasn't a rap battle. It wasn't predicated on dissing each other, trying to cut each other down, which is something that I personally do not get down with. Instead, it was a let's see who could rap incredible competition, which of course I was built for.
Somebody's getting a $5,000 grant, that's correct?
Definitely, without a doubt. I mean, that's what the whole tag.
It started off with like 40 MCs, right? Each round, the winner was determined based on crowd noise. The cats who get the loudest response are gonna go, you know, to the next round. And everybody got up in the first round and spit their bars and all that. Of course, I get up there. Boom, I shut it down with a verse.
Oh, crap! Oh, God, fouls on the ball open. People found me out smoking, I'll be out smoking. People in their house smoking, I'll be out voting. Don't get broke by the potent.
From the beginning, the crowd is loving me like crazy. Obviously, I'm on to the next round. Next round.
It is what it is, and it isn't what it was, and what it ain't. Is another dime a dozen. I don't covet, I create. When there's nothing in my cupboard, I'll be guzzling V8. I'm concerned about how the government and governor behave. I'm fed up with all the rubbish that the youngins emulate.
Can't nobody rhyme like me, and it's always been that way. So it becomes apparent that I am the crowd favorite, with the exception of one other person. Is this kid named Cash Flow. I remember the kid's name, Cash Flow. And Cash Flow was from across the street. He was from the building across the street and knew half the people in the park. I get to the last round. Comes down to me and Cash Flow. Cash Flow and I were going back and forth, and the crowd was just maximum noise, couldn't get no louder each time. The judges keep going, all right, go again. So we go about three extra rounds, and there was really no way to differentiate his crowd noise from my crowd noise. So they had to go and get this decibel noise meter reader. Once they brought the noise meter out, they had us do one more round, and I went first.
The most aggressive professor versus the senses, the self-sense of the message. I take adventures with my brother in heaven.
And I got bars until the earth stops spinning. So I spit all types of bars, right?
My soul with soldiers is shoulder to shoulder versus the soldiers that pull us over the sofas with hoses.
And the crowd made gigantic, stupendous, enormous noise. And you look on his device and it was super loud. And I'm like, yo, he's not gonna top that, this kid. You know what I mean? So then he gets up.
I mean, I thought I told y'all, come through the boy flow, known for the roll call. Listen here, dog, all I do is get cake. We bought 3 sixes out. We on the L date.
He spits his bars and, you know, I'm not trying to downplay him. He could rap.
Make some noise for Cash Flow, y'all.
And, like, I don't know if his cousins was there, mother, brother, aunts, uncles, aunts, sisters, sister-in-law, grandparents, whoever was there. They went berserk for him. They was screaming. People was getting nosebleeds. They went as wild as they can. And you look at the device when he was finished. I was down by 0.02. When they announced that he had beat me by those 0.02, you know, I try to never feel bad if I do my best. And I know I had done my best, but it didn't even make sense. I was like, nah, this can't. It can't be. It can't be that I didn't win this. You know what I mean? Like, he got it by the most slenderest of margins. That is just like if a bird flew overhead, the bird's wings would determine the outcome of the competition. And that was it. And he read it off. And the crowd was majorly like, no, hell no. Yeah, hell yeah. This is Tag Records when Jermaine Dupri was doing the Tag Records thing. A couple of minutes later, Jermaine Dupri emerges.
Listen, and it's so close. Y'all ain't.
Okay. He comes out, steps out on the stage, and he says, yo, it's a tie. Jermaine Dupri, you know, because he knows his hip hop, he said, this Sandman kid is not going to lose to this kid, Cash Flow. It's a tie. Done deal. They both going to get the money. Word to the mother. It was beautiful. It was beautiful. Maybe we'll have to split this and I'll get a nice $2,500. I'll go back to the judge with $2,500 and be like, all right, I'll give you a little more time. Yo, they gave me the full five G's. They gave me the full five G's, okay? As if I had won the joint outright. As it turns out, I got evicted 5 months later. Okay, I got evicted 5 months later, but in the 5 months that winning that competition bought me, such significant things happened in my career. The day that I got evicted, the next day I was leaving for 3 weeks to be on the road. The moral of the story is, go for it, son. Go for broke. You know you're going for broke because you broke. And when you go for broke, God is going to look out. And Jermaine Dupri is going to look out, too. Peace.
My sixth sense keen, my sees the existence squeezed between a heard and seen. My urban streets got rivers and streams, Burgundy. My insurance is WebMD. My cup runneth over, my tank runneth on empty. My man pointed out, even though there's no I in team, there's a M and E. My click ride deep, my crib 5D. My kicks and my tops endorsed. My pop like a pendulum, back and forth. The law in my city done got it enforced. The laws in my city are not enforced. My soul says for I'm sent for. My lieutenants don't tense up in the fourth 10-4.
Now, understand, the music for that piece, all of it, was from Homeboy Sandman's catalog. And it sounds nice, doesn't it? His latest project, All That I Hold Dear, is out now. He's got another album coming out soon, White Sands. We have a link to the world of Homeboy Sandman on our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Pat and Stevie Miller. When Snap returns, bring your rain gear, because it's going to get a little bit wet. And turn up that Barry White, because we're looking for some action. With Snap Judgment, the Look Back Special continues. Stay tuned.
Let's do it.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Look Back Special. Now, 2013, it was special for me in a lot of ways. You may know that every once in a while, we hit the road and rock stories on stage. One of the things I'm going to remember forever was bringing Snap Live back home to Michigan. And this show is personal. My mother was there, first time ever. Friends that I've had from childhood. Jim White from Michigan Public Radio, someone whom I've known since I was 3 years old, she introduced the show. And I was proud because Snap did not come half-stepping. We had some of the best storytellers in the world, backed by Alex Mandel and the Snap Judgment Players. This story marks Shannon Kaysen's first time ever on the Snap Live stage. It will not be his last.
Our next guest tonight is the second best-looking bald-headed black guy in tonight's show. All right. He's the first best-looking. A former Grand Slam moth champion. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce Mr. Shannon Case.
If you died today, where would you go? I used to do what's called street evangelism. That's when you go out into the crowded streets and basically you annoy people for Jesus. I I wasn't raised to be a Jesus freak. My dad is an original Detroit player. Gator shoes, women, money, running the streets. He had heard that his dad, he never met him, was a fast-talking, womanizing preacher who ran the streets. So I guess it was in my blood to run the streets in some way, except I was on the corner, hey, you want to talk to me about Jesus? I started going to this church in my early 20s, and I sold out at every service, an usher, an armor bearer, reading my Bible, living a celibate life, no women, a kid just trying my best to please God. I loved evangelism. We would go out in twos. I was paired up with the church secretary. Her name was Ethel. I love old-fashioned names. My mom's name is Bessie, and I'm a mama's boy. Ethel was fine, too. Tall, long legs, that's my thing. Amazons with vintage names. I had been celibate for 6 years at that point, but I still knew if a woman was fine, and she was. We would be out annoying heathens for Jesus together, and we weren't making people uncomfortable so much as getting comfortable with one another. And people at the church noticed that we had this chemistry together. But it was one of these churches where, like, the women at the church were Jesus's girl until you put a ring on it. So they split us up in evangelism, and the pastor told me, stop hanging around her. But stolen water tastes sweet. And bread eaten in secret is delicious. That's Proverbs 9:17, if anybody brought their Bibles, I don't know. So we were in a mutual friend's wedding, me and Ethel, and the bride paired us to walk down the aisle together because we were tall. And I remember I spun her around, and she laughed, the whole church laughed. Something about weddings. After the reception, we found ourselves alone, just me and Ethel. And we forgot about celibacy. We forgot about the pastor's rules, forgot about sin. We kissed, we touched, we held each other. And after it was done and that 6 year Jones had ended, I felt defeated. I felt like I had let God down. I remember I sat at the end of the bed while she dressed, and I felt naked. I mean, I really was naked. I hadn't put my clothes on yet, but y'all know what I'm talking about. She went to work the next day. She worked at the church. She was the secretary. And she told the pastor what happened. He calls me and tells me, come meet him at his office. I remember I walked past Ethel. She was acting busy at her desk. I went in his office and sat in his big chair. And this is a man I respected. I know he knew how bad I felt. He came in. He was like, that's why I told you not to hang around her. I knew this was going to happen. The next Sunday, at the beginning of the service, he calls me and Ethel to the front of the church. And the pastor says, tell them what happened. Full congregation, even in the balcony. And we confess our sins to everyone in detail. Ethel just stares at the ground. She says a few words. Me, I say, hey, everyone. I'm sorry for committing the sin of fornication with Ethel here. we went to the wedding. It was a nice wedding, and we were rubbing against each other. And then we had sex, and we're not married, and that's not right. I was crying and everything. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Ethel was accepted back into the fold. She was a good secretary, I guess. I was pushed out, discommunicated. Ethel never spoke to me again, ever. The pastor never spoke to me again, ever. After no communication with anyone at the church, my friends, roommates, I got the picture and left. Now, about 6 years later, and I'm gonna be honest with you, I wasn't celibate for those 6 years. I was getting it in, as they say. But about 6 years later, I saw a news report that the church went bankrupt. All the property was foreclosed on, and the church closed down. Now, I'm not saying that happened because the pastor did me wrong. I'm not saying that. It was one of these prosperity churches. The pastor was buying helicopters, jets, big houses, BMWs, stupid stuff. All this stuff, I don't know that really, if that really helps people. I wonder if the pastor went in front of the whole congregation and confessed for ruining the church's finances. I doubt it. I think he just moved to Florida. If you died today, where would you go? I think heaven has to be more than just good timing with asking forgiveness. It has to be. The other day, I ran into this kid, and he asked me to talk about Jesus. And I stopped and talked to him, and I could see myself in him, trying my damnedest to live right for God and for the approval of the people around me. I prayed with him the whole nine. And after it was over and he was going to go off to annoy other people for Jesus, I said, "Hey, kid, don't be afraid to live a little. Trust me, God will still love you." And before he left, I said, hey, inside scoop, if you mess up, don't tell the whole congregation. It's really none of their business. Take them to church, folks.
Shannon Kaysen from the Snap Judgment Live in Ann Arbor stage. Go on ahead, Shannon. The music that you just heard, it was brought to you by none other than the amazing Alex Mandel, the Snap Judgment players, David Brandt, and Tim Frick. And if you want to see how the entire show went down, we've got the film version on our website, snapjudgment.org. And what's more, Shannon Kaysen has a podcast. It's called Homemade Stories. Check it out on iTunes or wherever you get great stuff for free. We brought many writers into the Snap fold in 2013. One of my favorites is a woman by the name of Lydia Bird. Lydia spoke to us early this year, and she touched many listeners with her story of family straight from the heart.
It was October of 1971 when I was a junior in high school. My dad was invited by his work buddy, Bill Knorr, on a fishing expedition in Mexico. They both just retired from Family Life Insurance Company. Very few people knew that Dad had been asked to leave the company. Everyone there liked and admired him, but his numbers were way down because he was so caught up in Mom's drinking. Mom was very good at denial. She made it sound like they'd planned Dad's early retirement so they could spend more time traveling, and she encouraged Dad to do the trip with Bill. I encouraged him because I wanted him to do something for himself. I'd always seen Dad as a kind of hero in the way he dealt with Mom, but I was questioning that. If she passed out, he carried her to bed. If she broke something, he cleaned it up. He believed if he loved her enough, she'd find the strength to change. The expedition consisted of 10 boats that would start in San Felipe in the northern part of the Sea of Cortez and hop from anchorage to anchorage down the inside of the Baja Peninsula, then back again. Bill's boat was only 16 feet long. All the other boats were much bigger. Mom and I drove down with Dad to San Felipe, spent a couple of nights, saw the flotilla off, and headed back to LA with 2 full weeks ahead of us completely out of contact with Dad. She could be wonderful. I was really hoping she would be in good form, but she was drunk almost every day. On the 9th day, she was waiting for me in the kitchen when I got home from school. She was completely sober. She looked at me and said, "Your father and Bill have been missing for a week." She said, "We'll get through this." I felt the earth drop out from under me. He was the strong one in the family, and he was really my one clear source of unconditional love. So the sense of what the loss would be if he was gone, it would be enormous. It would be enormous. We learned some of the basics that afternoon from the Coast Guard. Dad and Bill had problems with the outboard the first couple of days and were slowing down the other boats. So they dropped out at a little settlement called Puerto Citos. The plan was to camp there, then rejoin the flotilla on its way back north. There was another American in the campground. As Dad was zipping up the tent before he and Bill took the boat out for a day of fishing, he told the guy jokingly, "If we're not back by sunset, send out the troops." They weren't back by sunset. Sometime after midnight, a chubasco hit, one of the sudden, violent storms the Sea of Cortez is notorious for. It took nearly a week for the young American to put it all together. The empty tent, the missing boat, the crashing waves. But he rode the bus to the closest phone and set things in motion. By the time the news reached me and Mom, Dad and Bill had been missing longer than anyone had ever survived in an open boat in those waters, in those conditions. All I could think was, how are we going to survive without him? The Coast Guard started searching early the next morning, along with a number of search and rescue volunteers. Dad and Bill's boss dropped everything and flew down in his own twin-engine Aero Commander. He was great. He updated us several times a day. The story got onto the AP wires, and Mom fielded panic phone calls from friends. She dealt with reporters. Mom was convinced that he was alive. Mom rarely bothered to access her own strength. But those 3 days, her strength was astonishing, and her belief in Dad's survival was unwavering. Late on the 3rd day of the search, the Coast Guard announced that survival beyond 10 days was not likely, and they would not be resuming the operation the following morning. Mom would not accept that Dad was gone, and it scared me. Or I was scared of what was going to happen when her denial broke down. The thing is, it was a completely different kind of denial than I was used to from Mom. It wasn't a negative force, it was positive. She just knew he was alive. On the final pass of that final day, just before dusk, the Coast Guard spotted the little boat in the masses of white caps. 20 minutes later, the rescue helicopter arrived. We have a photo of Dad and Bill with the clean-cut Coast Guard crews on the Mexican mainland. Dad and Bill have wild hair and 10-day beards, but they were in surprisingly good health and insisted on going to a hotel with hot showers, not to a hospital. Mom and I talked to Dad that night from his hotel in Hermosillo. He sounded so good, so clear, even after that life and death ordeal. He told us how the engine failed spectacularly on their way in from fishing, how the anchor caught as the last of the line went out, then pulled up in the steep waves of the Chabasco, which eventually blew them 50 miles offshore. They brought food and water for lunch. Everything else was in the campground. By the sixth day, their water ration was down to a swallow apiece, and their tongues were swelling in their mouths. Bill had lost his wife the year before. He pretty much gave up and was ready to die. Dad looked around that 16-foot boat and figured out what he could use to distill salt water into fresh. He used empty oil cans and a hose from the bait tank. He mixed gas and oil as fuel, then sparked wires from the battery to light it. He and Bill produced more than enough water to bring themselves back from the brink. Dad joked that the only food he really craved was raw fish. They were on a fishing boat and they couldn't catch a fish. He said, "We even saw them and they as good as thumbed their noses at us." The Coast Guard flew Dad to San Diego and his boss insisted on flying me and Mom down in the Aero Commander to bring him home. Mom hadn't touched a drop of alcohol in 4 days. But she started drinking in the morning and was incoherently drunk by the time we landed in San Diego. I'll never forget the moment Dad came out of the debriefing room. He was wearing clean jeans and a Coast Guard t-shirt. He looked handsome and strong, this man who'd outsmarted death. He came through the door and saw us, his former boss, whom he hugely respected, and his daughter, and his wife, so drunk she could barely stand. I watched as the open hope on his face closed down in defeat. I actually tried to talk him into leaving her more than once, but I've come to recognize that he fought to stay alive in the Sea of Cortez because he refused to leave any of us. For better or for worse, and this is literally for better or for worse, I do think that they had a connection that few people have. I find myself believing she really did know. All these years later, I've come to see their story as a love story. My parents died within 5 months of each other, 22 years after Dad was lost at sea. Mom kept drinking, and Dad kept loving her.
Thank you so much, Lydia. Lydia is currently writing a book of her memoirs. That piece was produced by Snap Judgment's Stephanie Fu. Now you know that 2013 was our biggest year yet. And with it, there were so many stories that there's no way we could fit them all into our Look Back special. So we got to cook up a mix of some of our favorite moments over the year. Go on ahead. Hit it, Pat.
Oh, yeah. I hopped a freight train when I was 9 years old and ran away from home.
Wow. I said no more, no more.
We called her Comrade Grin.
Started to wander off.
I've been up to the mountain and to the pyramid.
But it was so clear.
He said, when you're rolling around like a drunk in a bar, why don't you learn to box?
You can make more money in one fight than taking 3 months to pick scrap metal.
He said, look, this is what I've done to put a dent in racism. I've got robes and hoods hanging in my closet by people who've given up that belief. How many robes and hoods have you collected?
If somebody has told me in 40 years from now, you would be doing the execution for Saddam Hussein, I would have probably laughed and ridiculed it.
We just want democracy. We just want truth.
It's
It's hard to grow up in America as an Asian woman and not encounter some usually Caucasian man who has this unusual attraction for Asian women.
J Dilla is my son. He is the most genius beat maker that ever existed.
Thank you, JD.
Listen to his tapes.
Welcome to Snap Judgment.
You're listening to Snap Judgment, the Look Back Special. And when we return, a mother finds the strangest helper you ever heard, and she's not letting him go without a fight. When the Look Back Special continues, stay tuned. Back to Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, the Look Back Special. My name is Glenn Washington, and today we're taking a ride down memory lane and highlighting just some of the stories from 2013. Our next piece begins in what seems like a normal place. A young woman gives birth to a baby boy, but pretty soon, things take a turn.
George was an unusual baby, just cried, very agitated, and the first signs immediately to everybody was that there is something wrong with him. 3 to 6 months come along, he never smiled. I started to take him backwards and forwards to the hospital, obviously, because he showed signs of almost, as I touched him, like he was on fire. And then he would walk around the house when he did learn to walk, but wouldn't look my way. There was never, ever any kind of communication between me and George. There was nothing at all. And the most difficult thing, I think, for me was having no affection towards me, never touching him, never being able to hold him. If I went near him, he would scream. The closest I got to him is when he was in a deep sleep, because we used to give him a cow pole then to help him to sleep, to make him relaxed. He used to have curly blonde hair, and I used to wait till he was in a deep sleep just to be able to feel and touch his hair. Do you know, I used to sit and imagine what it would be like to hear him talk, if you get what I'm saying. People said, oh, has your child been abused? That's why you don't talk. You hear the mothers gossiping at the school that your child couldn't speak. And then doctors started to get involved, and they done many tests on him. They did say that he does have a blank on his brain. He then got diagnosed on the Asperger's and autistic spectrum, but being diagnosed didn't really help. And it's something I just got used to, really, that I was going to live with this child and accept him for what he is. There was a stray cat that came into our garden with blood down its neck, and it really distressed me. I wasn't the biggest of cat fans to start with, because my mum was known as Catwoman. There must have been up to 28, 29 at a time in my mum's house. It obviously got caught on someone's fence or something. Well, I ran around. I said, oh my God, this cat's covered in blood. So we got some food. I told George all about it and said, this poor cat's really sick. I've got to catch it in this box. Because what it is with George is, even though he didn't talk at all, I've always talked to him. And so I'm explaining to George still. George isn't answering, but George is listening all the time and looking and watching everything. And absolutely, I mean, I still feel mad saying it now. Out of nowhere, George said in a high-pitched voice, it's like a cartoon character, boo-boo, boo-boo. Well, this is coming out of a child who had never spoke. I froze just thinking to myself, my child for the first time in 7 years talking. Am I imagining he's just done those sort of sounds, funny high-pitched sounds, or... I said to him, what are you doing? What are you doing? Boo-boo, boo-boo. I said, you talking to the cat? Is that the cat's name? Boo-boo, boo-boo. I came straight in to phone my mum to tell my mum what had happened. I went from the cat to the psychiatrist to George's dad to everybody in the phone book. Everyone thought I was totally mad, but all drove over here. So we had a whole house of people with him walking around saying this high-pitched voice baboo thing. They heard it themselves. They all stood staring at each other and they thought, oh, thank God the mum's not lost it. The child's talking. That was the actual start of him talking. So I thought, well, that's the start of something. So we brought the cat home. He was there in our family. He decided to name the cat Ben. Ben would follow George around. I mean, it was like having a dog. He talked through the cat. Everything was in this high-pitched voice, and then he played through the cat. It was really like a real proper friendship. They would have a routine bit of play. The cat had to sit up the dinner table and eat dinner with us. And I went along with it because if George asked for a fish finger, the cat had a fish finger. And whilst George said fish finger, I was happy for the cat to sit at the table. And that's how it worked. And George went on and asked for a trampoline. And the minute George got on his trampoline, the cat would have to get on it. It was so funny to watch, but the cat liked it. George used to just absolutely, absolutely laugh. I had never heard George laugh, see? And no one else likes the child, or he hasn't got any friends. He's only got the cat. The cat started purring and rubbing up my legs. And I said to George, when it purrs, it's doing something it done to its mum. It wants love. So when the cat done that to my leg, George done the same. That's the first time George has ever cuddled me by rubbing up my legs. And everyone said, oh, well, now it is getting strange, letting your son rub up your leg like a cat. Don't mix with him, his mother's not right. You know, he's acting like a cat. It's all right for other people to judge, but they hadn't had a child for 7 years that never give him any attention. Long time to wait, isn't it, you know? Everything was running really smooth and we was having a great time and we decided to go on a holiday. We had George's dad come and stay here to look after Ben. We got to day 3 of our holiday and we got a phone call to say that Ben had gone missing. Well, immediately there was complete and utter blank. George, he just absolutely went stiff. He packed his bag and he looked at me and he said, we've got to go home, haven't we, and get him back. We actually flew home on day 4. We went on this mission to try and find our cat. All day long, all night, I had phone calls. I opened a Facebook page. I opened a website. I was going to local shops, post offices, pubs. I was handing out posters of a night. I nearly got arrested outside the local school for handing out leaflets. But I continued to do it, hoping that they would arrest me, because then I would get free advertising in the local newspaper, because we couldn't afford to do it any other way. I wanted it on the side of the bus and I wanted it on the TV because I just wanted to say to people, look, this cat made my child talk. I got many, many, many phone calls. I had thousands of people help me. Every dead animal that got run over, I got called to pick it up to say, is it him? George was very depressed. He didn't eat. He stayed in his room. It became like a full-time job. Local people said, oh, here comes the mad cat woman. I've got myself a terrible name, but I was so desperate. Please, somebody help. It was getting nearer to Christmas, and obviously Christmas was out the window. George wouldn't leave the house. Friends, close friends, they said, you know, you're really tiring, you look ill, and maybe you should, at this point, say to George, should we think about getting another cat? So 3 months later, at this desperate point, I got this phone call from this lady. Hi, I've got a cat in my conservatory. Is your name Julia Romp? I said, oh my God, I can't believe it. Where are you? Expecting her to say Hounslow, Isleworth, somewhere in London. She said, I'm in Brighton, my love. Well, I'm not kidding you. I nearly fell off the chair. Well, Brighton's like 90 miles. Is it 90 or 80? I got to this house, knocked on the door. I was so nervous. And there's this whole family stood at the door, all really smiling like that. It was like they were going to sing carols to me or something like that. They started giving me tea and biscuits and saying, oh, your clothes are wet. And, you know, they didn't just go and get my cat. All I kept thinking about is, where's the cat? Where's the cat? She said, don't worry, I am going to take you to your cat. They opened a door and I could not believe it. My heart just, I felt like it dropped out my boot. And he popped his little head out the basket and he ran, jumped in my arms. As I tried to take him off of me like a baby, this cat, and pull his neck away from my neck, do you know he held on to me? I kept saying, come on, Babu, I've got to put you in the basket to get you home. We couldn't get him off me. We come back and all of a sudden, as I got really close to home, it was pumping through my thoughts and my feelings. How's George going to react? My God, you don't think, you know, I hope he doesn't not feel right about it, the fact he's gone. So I shouted out to George up the stairs. I said, George, Mummy's home and Babu's here. He come running down the stairs and he had this massive big smile on his face. And I could just see, you know, you can just see in his face. I could just see. And I said, oh, here he is. Here's Babu. And he said, oh, my God. And then he made jokes and got him out. And he was just as loving as ever. And I was totally exhausted. I just sat on the sofa and George pulled everything down, the Christmas tree, the decorations. And I just let him just jump around the front room and them two carry on. And they danced and he laughed and he carried on as normal. George was 7 when he had Ben. He's now 16. He goes to college now. You know, I'm not saying he's 100% social. He does find life very difficult. But he is one fine, kind, nice person. I swore blind I'd never turn out like my mother. Being brought up with cats, lots of cats, let me tell you. The cats were more important than us. As a child, I just said that when I grow up, I was going to have a hair-free, cat-free house. Little did I know that later on in life, and I was not only going to turn into me mother, I've got 3 ferals living with me at the moment, and I ended up saving Ben. And Ben opened George's world and saved my life. That taught me a lesson, didn't it? Yeah, never mind.
The cat came back, I thought he was a goner, but the cat came back, cause he wouldn't stay away.
All right now, some of you might want to have a little cry, that's all right. Big thanks to Julia Romp for sharing that story with Snap. Find out more about Julia's story at our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Anna Sussman, with sound design by Renzel Goriel. Now then, you've come a long way with Snap this year, but no, there is plenty more where this came from. Stories, 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 full episodes, podcasts, movies, more than you can shake a stick at. Waiting for you right now at snapjudgment.org and Facebook. Yes, we have the Facebook. Twitter. Yes, we have the Twitter. This show, it was produced by myself and the grandest group of Yuletide revelers the world has ever seen. Give it up for Mr. New Year himself, the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. Taking the year out with the beat instead of a bang, Pat Macedi Miller. Stephanie, I'll see you in February, foo. Anna Sussman likes jam. Julia DeWitt likes spam. Renzel Goriel enjoys clam. And while everyone's celebrating, Will Urbina gets a good night's sleep because he has to be up early in the morning. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting is not, I repeat, is not taking on all comers in oiled arm wrestling down at Joe's Tavern this weekend. And it's not because they're too chicken to show up. Ha ha! Too chicken! Much love, the CPB. WBEZ Chicago knows how to WBEZ in Chicago. PRX Public Radio Exchange throws the best New Year's parties every single day of the year. And they don't mind if you stop by anytime. Tell them Snap sent you. PRX.org. And you know this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could shove all your leftovers from Halloween, from Thanksgiving, from Christmas, onto a single sandwich, and you could consume said sandwich, and when you wake up in the emergency room, you would still not be as far away from the news as this is, but this is NPR.